Our speaker today, as I said, is Dr. Paul. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
And I am absolutely delighted to be here. And I agree with everything Greg has said about meeting everybody. And I was thinking, one of the happiest things about being here so far is asked Steve about how many of us there were here, and he said at least 350. And which is fine, but the real key point is we are it. We are the only people here. We are filling the place up. The point being that anybody you meet at any time during this weekend in the activities or whatever else is one of us. And you say hello to them. You say, and you run up and give them a hug. And the biggest problem that creates for me is I get so used to saying hello to everybody that when I leave here, I say hello to men in the John and the airport and all kinds of stuff. It's hard to stop. But I'll take care of that a week from now. What I'd like to see. Another thing that bothers me is that on cruises and trips and stuff like that, about the time you're ready to go home, then people exchange phone numbers and addresses and get to know everybody. And that's a shame. We need to know each other while we're here. In fact, you're all sitting there looking so damn serious. I mean, I don't really expect, I hope you're not expecting me to say something profound. The most profound thing I can say is I'm an alcoholic. But for instance, I'd like to have us go around the room and introduce ourselves. But that would take too long. So why don't we, at the count of three, why don't everybody state your name and your disease? At the count of three. One, two, three. My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. You did that very well. Now, do you realize that now you know everybody in this room? So you have absolutely no reason. Well, let's make it even better than that. I'm really impressed with the number of people here for the first time. That's terrific. Let's see that again. People here, their first sober club med. Raise your hand. Let's look at that. Let's give them a hand. Please. We saw the hands of the alcoholics. Let's do that again. All the alcoholics, please raise your hand. Oh, God, the place is crawling with alcoholics. I've always been impressed with the number of alcoholics that you see at AA meetings. What about cocaine addicts, dopers? How about the cocaine people? The cocaine, raise your hand. See, they're the real sickies. But what about pill heads? Any pill heads here? Oh yeah, lots of pill heads. I mean, the doctors and the pharmacists love you. I mean. And what else we got? What about some more? What? Pot. You mean marijuana? Anybody here smoke pot? I don't. Oh my goodness, quite a few. That's been always been one of my basic resentments. I have never smoked pot. I have never had the pleasure of meeting pot. I mean, it wasn't because I wouldn't try it. It's because I couldn't find any. I got sober too soon. It was 29 years ago, and I remember, I would think about it, and I knew they had marijuana on the parochial school playground just down the street, and I wanted to go get some, but I could just see the headline in the Alliance Review. Prominent local physician arrested for selling pot on the parochial school ground. Yeah. And I thought my defense of saying, no, I wasn't selling, I was buying, didn't sound like much. I was afraid to go get some, but I never tried any marijuana. I felt real bad about that until I found a guy that got sober so early and he had never tried vodka. Wouldn't that be awful to have never tried vodka? it leaves you breathless. You could drink forever with that. And, what about other drugs?
LSD.
What's that? Anybody on LSD and the recreational drugs? Ecstasy? Oh, gee, we really got some sickies here this time. And what about the real sickies? The Al-Anons. Don't be ashamed. Put your hand up. I'll put mine up, too. I go to Al-Anon every week. I don't. Max isn't an alcoholic. I feel a little bit like an imposter, but I have a son-in-law. And as far as I know, the only significant thing he's ever done in life was make me eligible for Al-Anon. And I love Al-Anon. In fact, I find it interesting. People talk about a problem. One of the most common problems I hear from other people is that somebody's going crazy in a relationship with another alcoholic. And I suggest, I said, well, that's an Al-Anon problem. Why don't you go to Al-Anon? And they're insulted. Me? Go to Al-Anon? I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I've come to the conclusion that Alcoholics Anonymous, the only place you'll find people who are convinced that being an alcoholic makes you more of a person than a non-alcoholic. But the main thing is, what I'd like to see, I like hugs. And I'd like to see you all stand up and hug at least two or three other people. Somebody you didn't come with. And just, come on, just stand up and hug some people. Thank you. Now, don't you all feel better?
Yeah.
Have you ever had that happen at an AA meeting before? But this is unusual AA meetings here. These are what I would consider generic AA meetings. I mean, everything, well, almost everything goes at these meetings. And like it was said here, I think a guy said that if you have a meeting you want of some other group, and you don't find it on the list, start one. Don't whine about not having it. Start it. If it's not started, it's your fault. And it's very easy. It's almost as easy as signing up for a massage. I'm just delighted to be here. I like being an alcoholic. I just love being an alcoholic. I think being an alcoholic is a lot of fun. This is the best life I've ever known. I thoroughly enjoy it. My marriage is the best it's ever been. Max, stand up. And this is Max. She drove me to drink for 28 years. She drove me to drink for 28 years, and now
I've been sober for 28 years. So
we've been married for 56 years. And wow is right, yeah. You're nowhere near as impressed as I am. No, that's been quite a deal. And everything about my life is getting better and better. I think everybody ought to be an alcoholic. And sometimes I think maybe they're making them faster than we're curing them anyway. But I like this way of life. It's surprising that I do like it so much because it's amazing how hard I fought trying to stay out there to stay away from here. And I guess you have as much trouble hearing as I hear at this thing. Is that any better now? Okay. Up? You want me to raise it? Talk louder? Well, that only took half an hour. Let's see. My name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. Start out with everybody naming themselves. Anyhow, I went to a lot of trouble living this story, and by God, I don't want you to miss any of it. I'm always concerned about the people who have heard me before, and I was thinking I ought to get a new story. But then I wasn't sure I'd be able to meet the plane getting out here, and uh, to, I wouldn't know whether when I got back for the thing. So anyway, as I was saying, I'm surprised. It's surprising that I enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous as much as. In fact, if it bothers you, if you're relatively new or whatever, even if you're not new, and it bothers you to hear me say that I enjoy being an alcoholic, because I hear people say they're glad to have the program, but they're not glad to be alcoholic. And I always think, well, what the hell good would the program be if you were an alcoholic? I hardly ever see any non-alcoholic running in and say, would you listen to my fifth step? I think we have to be threatened to be die drunk if we don't do these steps, otherwise we'd never do them. And so I'm glad to be alcoholic and glad to have this program and be part of this, in spite of the fact that I fought real hard trying to stay out there to keep from being here. And I wouldn't have even come here, I don't know, ever. I wasn't sent here. I wasn't sent here by a judge. I wasn't that bad. I wasn't. I didn't have to have a court card. The only reason I came to AA in the first place was that getting a pass to come to an AA meeting was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And there was nothing funny about that. In fact, it was a very boring place to be. They were fanatics there on occupational therapy. They wanted, they insisted that you make leather belts. In fact, I don't think you could graduate from there if you didn't make leather belts or ashtray or something really useful. And they were really fanatics on it, and they kept insisting that I learn how to make leather belts, and I couldn't see the philosophy. They tried to convince me that the quality of my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. And I told them I have a whole wall with licenses and certificates and diplomas and papers to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence. And I don't see how me knowing how to make leather belts would improve the quality of my life one bit. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. That wasn't my fault. That was the fault of this dumb occupational therapist. Because I've always had a theory that if you don't understand a thing well enough so you can explain it to me, then you don't understand it nearly as well as you're supposed to. And she had already told me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And I remember sitting there in the nut ward commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes and misdiagnoses, because I had a brain tumor, and they had missed it. And here I was in the nut ward by mistake, and thinking of all these things going on when this psychiatrist walked up behind me, and he was a stupid psychiatrist. He couldn't see that my problems were marital. And walked up behind me and asked me, would I mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, my God, doctor, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I was willing to go to any length to make him happy. And I said yes, and went off to the meeting. And I don't remember the meeting. I don't remember. In fact, I don't know how many meetings they went to before I knew what meeting I was at. But I know that meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He was delighted. And full of questions now. He'd always been ignoring me before. Now he's full of questions. He wondered, what's this about the book? What's this about steps? What's this about other meetings? How often do they have meetings? How often are you going to go? What other kind of meetings do they have? All these questions. I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. And he's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. And I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to before I could get him sober. So I went to all the meetings I could, and finally got my enough brownie points, and I got my discharge button, had no intention of going back again. Why would I? I wasn't even an alcoholic. And So what happened was that Max had been going to the meetings, and she liked him. And, of course, once I found out she liked the meetings, I would use that against her. And if she didn't behave right, I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. And I said that once too often. And she ended up, have you ever tried sitting home on a Saturday night drinking while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? I found it real boring. And so I had to go back to the meetings to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. And I found out they were laughing at anything. Alcoholics just laughed. I sat there for 7 months, listened to them, trying to figure it out. And one night I found myself laughing with them. And I haven't had a drink since. And the laughter has been very therapeutic and actually very spiritual for me. The laughter is very spiritual in AA for me. In fact, I'm convinced that my higher power laughs every time he hears alcoholics laugh, whether he gets the joke or not. And that's how I got to be an alcoholic. It took me 7 months. I was coming to AA for 7 months, and I wasn't an alcoholic, but I was associating with all these alcoholics, and I turned into at least a very mild alcoholic. When I first became an alcoholic. Yeah, when I first became alcoholic, I was very mild. Very mild. Almost non-alcoholic. But it was more allergic to alcohol. I was allergic to alcohol, but I wasn't a drunkard. I wasn't a wino. I wasn't a lush. Certainly wasn't a skid row bum. But I was kind of allergic to alcohol. But the problem with that was that once I found out I was an alcoholic, then I decided I wanted to be... I came to AA feeling like a failure in all departments. Just a failure in all departments. And I was really ashamed when I ended up in AA, for God's sake, the bottom of the social barrel. But then when I became a mild alcoholic, I thought, well, I ought to at least succeed in this one thing, for God's sake. I certainly ought to, this is one thing I'll at least be a success in. So I decided I was going to be, quote, a successful member of AA. And I set out to be a successful member of AA. And over the years, I periodically have changed, to some extent, my definition, my own personal definition of what a successful member of AA is. I consistently realize that successful members of AA don't drink. And so in fact, we used to talk about, back then, they used to keep saying, stick with the winners. And what I've set myself up to do is to act like a winner. Act like a winner. When I don't know what else to do with a problem or a situation or whatever, I ask myself, what would an AA winner do? And try to act like an AA winner, whatever that is. And that's kept me sober, because as I say, winners don't drink. In fact, that's the way we do it in AA. And I've always been impressed in AA how we don't drink. We just don't drink, no matter what. We don't drink. No matter what happens. No matter what doesn't happen. You know, whatever. We don't drink. In AA, we don't drink. No matter what, we don't drink. In fact, I think that I haven't even had an occasional social drink. I haven't had anything to drink. In AA, we don't drink. In fact, we're kind of noted for not drinking. I think that not drinking has a lot to do with my sobriety. They just don't drink. As a result of trying to be a successful member of AA, I had to keep coming to meetings, of course. Not only did I have to keep coming to meetings, I had to work the steps. I see a lot of people who try to stay sober on just the fellowship, just the meetings. And and can stay real comfortably sober right up to the point where they get drunk. And then wonder what happened. I was going to meetings every day. You know, I think it takes, I don't know, for me it takes both. It takes both the fellowship and the program and the steps. And I have redone all the steps to the best of my ability, not by plan, but just it has worked out that way, an average of every 5 years. And every time I've done that, I've moved to a new plateau in my sobriety. Just like the first time I did it. I'm not saying you should do that. I know a lot of people think you just do the steps once, and then from then on you just do the maintenance thing. And there are other people that like to redo the steps every year on their birthday or something like that. Well, I'm saying whatever works for you, fine. I'm just telling you what has worked for me, and I enjoy doing that. And no, that's not true. I don't enjoy doing that. I'm glad that every time I've done it, I've been glad that I did it. And but the problem, what happens, you see, not only is it they say it's a progressive disease, and when I had decided I had to go to meetings and keep, in order to stay sober, I kept getting re-exposed to alcoholics, and I kept getting worse as the disease. My disease kept getting worse, and today, I am much, 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 much more alcoholic than I was when I first became alcoholic. Like I say, when I first became alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all. Today I'm much more alcoholic. Today I'm a real alcoholic. And I've even taken a few pills, but I never became addicted to pills or narcotics. You can't, any doctor will tell you can't get addicted to pills unless you abuse them. You have to abuse the pill in order to get addicted to it. Any doctor will tell you that. I don't know what that means. I don't even know how. I don't know how to abuse a pill. How do you abuse a pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know, and stomp on the thing. You know, verbally abuse it. You dirty, rotten little pill. Why don't you do what I told you? You know, but, I don't know. I never abused a pill in my life. I was always very. They were very tiny. Just to look at them, you could see they were. Very mild. In fact, I was very careful where I even carried my pills. I used to keep them with my change. People say, you got change for a dollar? And I say, yeah. And I'd go like that. And they'd say, oh, you carry second all around in the daytime. Yeah. I put it over with my keys. And I'd go out in the car to the parking lot and I'd take the keys out of my pocket. And a Quaalude, run down the street, you know. It was always run faster than I could run. Yeah. And I didn't dare stomp on it, or I'd abuse it. And I've never abused a pill in my life. And but by being exposed to more alcoholics, I just got more and more alcoholic. And that's how I come to realize that alcoholism is not only a disease, it's a contagious disease. You get it from other alcoholics. And people that are here this week that aren't really alcoholic, I don't know if you realize what a dangerous situation you're in. Alcoholics have given it to you. Not only is it contagious, they're glad to give it to you. They feel proud of themselves to make you alcoholic. So you're in a very dangerous situation here. And you need to be careful. Be careful what you listen to, because it's a virus, and it goes in through your ears and affects your brain. That's how I've gotten to be more and more alcoholic the longer I've been here. Another thing that's happened to me was that it has affected my thinking. My sponsor tells me, he says, Paul, don't drink and don't think. My problems, I don't have a drinking problem. I don't have any problems related to drinking as long as I don't drink. But my difficulty is that I can't keep from thinking. I can keep from drinking with your help and God's help in the program, but I can't keep from thinking. And I have a lot of problems with that because my mind has a mind of its own. And I will find it I will find it thinking about the dumbest things. What in the hell are you thinking about that for? I'll be riding along in the car, fighting with somebody, having a tremendous argument, and winning. It's a continuation of an argument I lost years ago. And the voice will say to me, "Who are you talking to? We are alone here." And that happens all the time. And it talks to me. I don't know how I think by somebody talking to me, talking. It's just all the time talking. The voice is talking. And it's even now that somebody up there will, I'm trying to talk to you in somewhat of a straight line, somewhat coordinated, and they will make a suggestion. And before I can say anything about it, another will make a different suggestion. And before I can talk about that one, they get to fighting about whether I should talk about one or the other. And then others will join in, and they get to fighting back and forth up there as to what I should talk about. And it's very distracting, very confusing. And shut up there! Yeah. And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. But talk, all the time, talk. A lot of times I'll be tired at night and I'll lie down. My body wants to lie down and go to sleep. My brain says, "No, let's lie here and talk about it for a while," Or even 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, they'll say, "Hey, wake up, we've had an emergency meeting and we need to talk to you." You know that deal that you thought you handled so well today? It wasn't like that at all. They're really ticked off at you. You wait till morning, you'll find out. And I think, God, I don't want to listen to that nonsense. And I'll roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I'm about to lose consciousness, I'll think, "Boy, I'm sure glad I'm not thinking about that anymore." And one of them will say, "Oh, I'm glad you're still awake." That's not the only time you did that. About 6 months ago, you did the same thing. In fact, you've done a lot of stupid things. In fact, let's spend the rest of the night lying here making lists of stupid things you have done. If there's anything that the program's helped me with, it's helped me get used to the idea of getting along better with the voices in my head. I used to fight them. Just like the one that no matter what's going on, he always had the same suggestion. "Well, let's have a drink." It used to be when he'd say that, it was almost like it was a command from God that we should all have a drink. And now, some of the things they say, "God, I'm glad you can't hear them." Some of the things are not only illegal, but they're lewd, and it's bad enough I have to listen to them. And now what happens, instead of fighting, I can say, "Well, thank you for participating. Now if you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else." And there's a meeting going on all the time. What I found is, whoever I listen to the most, they speak the loudest and come to the front of the room and talk the most. And who ends up, once I say, "That's okay, but I don't fight them, don't put any energy into it, and let it go," they move to the back of the room. And I don't hear the voice that says, "Let's have a drink." I haven't heard his voice in a long time. But I know he's still there. Nobody ever leaves, but they're still there. And in fact, I've done that with defects of character on my seventh step. What I do is tell, when I have a defect like depression, or I love being depressed. You ever been depressed? I love being depressed. Depression has a lot of redeeming social value. Because it narrows life down so much. All the problems in the world come narrowed right down to just me. And I like it simplified. But my problem is that I often can't distinguish between depression and self-pity. But depression, fear, insomnia, I'll tell God, I'd like to have this removed. I've become willing to have it removed. I ask Him to remove it. And then act as if he has. In fact, I'll tell him, I'd like to have you take this, and I'd like you to have it removed. I'd like to take it and remove it completely. But I know there's that business in the seven-step prayer about maybe it's useful to you or to my fellows. So maybe you don't want to remove it completely, but I'd like to have you remove most of it. Take it, know that I'd like to be completely rid of it, sleep on it tonight, and in the morning you give me the amount of it you want me to have. And I'll accept it as a gift from you. So that actually what it is that I no longer fight it. And so I still have my defects, but I no longer fight them. And all I can say is I and my higher power are doing the best we can. And if my defects bother you, that's too damn bad. I'm not going to fight it anymore. And anyhow, it all gets back, as I say, to attitudes. Somebody told me early, AA means altered attitudes. And I fit, somebody gave me a slip of paper the other day by somebody named Swindoll, who I guess is a television evangelist. And if the television evangelist says it, you know it must be true. He was saying that in his opinion, life was life. Life was 10%. Life is 10% what happens. And 90% attitude. I've always been convinced that my life, the quality of my life doesn't depend on what happens, it depends on what the people in my head think about what happens. It's the same way with my relationship with Max. My relationship with Max doesn't depend on what she does. My relationship with Max depends on who of the people in my head I listen to who are interpreting what she does. Were the ones that are telling me that that's a cruddy thing for her to do or whatever. That it's my attitude is what determines whether we get along well, not what she does. I can know, in fact, we'll be getting into this later in the week, but I've given her written paper stating my declaration of my independence, that she is no longer responsible for my feelings, and I'm no longer responsible for hers. But that all has to do with attitude. I'm really convinced that attitude is so important. And it's very important for us here. Guy and Steve and the Club Med and Ryan and all have really done and Jet have all done a great deal of work. A great deal of work to set this whole thing up so that we can have a tremendous week. And yet all their work together isn't really worth a damn if as far as competing with our attitude. It's really impossible for them to make us have a good time if we have a bad attitude. Like somebody said, it's hard to have a good day with a bad attitude, and it's hard to have a bad day with a good attitude. So that our life, actually, our time here, and all depends on our attitude. In fact, let me close with this, because I'm, in spite of what he says, I want to all rush for the food. You know. We'll let Guy wait. He can wait and we'll go eat, you know. But I've heard it all my life, you know, that when we die, we have a pre-admission interview with St. Peter. And he'll ask us whether we've been good or bad. Now, they wouldn't tell us that if it weren't true, but I've never met anybody who's been there and knows that's what happens. And he maybe will ask us if we've been good or bad, but I don't think that'll be, no matter what else he might ask, I think what he's really going to ask, and the thing he's really going to be interested in, is I think he's going to ask us, what was your predominant attitude down there? What was your predominant mood down there? And you probably want to say something about guilt or something. And you say, no, no, no. Everybody that comes up here wants to talk about guilt. And no. He's going to say, I know that you know that this is a place of happiness, peace, and joy. What you don't know is how we keep it this way. disgruntled, unhappy, resentful, fault-finding people, we have a special place for them. What we like are people who have the right attitude. In fact, you're standing over the trapdoor. With that in mind, what was your predominant attitude while you were down there? I think that's what he's going to ask. And so what I'm saying is, I think our lives throughout eternity, and certainly all the time we're here, is going to depend on our attitude. And I think that the way I see life is that our job is to enjoy life. It says it right in our book. I've studied many textbooks of medicine, but I've never studied one that has the statement in it that's in the very, 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 very middle of page 132, after you've done the steps, right in the middle, the very, very middle of 132, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. That's a major part of our program. It's there in our big book. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I think our job is to enjoy life, whether we like it or not. Have a good weekend, or a good week. Thank you all very much.